Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. You are listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Lauren Corman, here with Carl Orzechowski, teching for us today. This is kind of the Valentine's Day show on Animal Voices. I was hoping to speak with the people who run Chocolate Decadence, which is a vegan-owned chocolate company that they do only fair trade chocolates, but we weren't able to hook up an interview with them, although we are going to be doing a segment at the end of the program. We talk about fair trade chocolate for all your Valentine's Day needs. But today's program, we're going to be speaking with two different guests. The first up, we're going to be speaking with Steve Fish, who is the proprietor of Left Feet, which is a vegan-owned vegan shoe store in Toronto. It's so amazing that this even exists. And that shoe store offers fair trade items as well. Then we're going to be speaking with Camilla Taylor, who is an artist, an artisan, who runs veganerotica.com, which makes a bunch of sexy items for vegans who are interested in not purchasing leather. We're going to talk to her about making these items and some of the things that go into this labor of love for her. Find out more about SM and veganism for people who are not comfortable with hearing about sex or sex-related topics. This might not be the show for you. If you're curious, though, what veganism and SM might have in common, this will be an interesting program, certainly a controversial one. So that we'll be speaking with Camilla at about 11:15. But first, we're going to take a little short musical break. We'll come back with Steve Fish, find out about Manatee Nights, which is a fun night at Fresen Restaurant in Toronto, trying to get animal rights, vegetarian and vegan folks out to mingle and hear some great music. And we're going to find out why vegan socializing is so important to Steve Fish. So please stay tuned. Hello and welcome back to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FM. I want to let people know if you're interested in hearing this program or any of our archived programs, you can go to our website, animalvoices.ca. We have over 180 shows archived there that are free for downloading, so check it out. Also, we have a survey. I know I've been promoting this for a while now, but if you're interested, it takes about 5 minutes or less to fill out the survey that is linked on our Animal Voices website. Again, animalvoices.ca. It's a great way for you to give us some feedback about the show and the future direction of the program. We also have a new MySpace for people who want to be our MySpace friend. It's myspace.com and then /animalvoices. We would love to befriend you. There's also a section there where we do some blogging about the program, so you can get a behind-the-scenes look at the show as well as get all the updates for future programs to know what we're doing in the weeks to come. Today on Animal Voices, we're doing sort of a little bit of a Valentine's Day show, and we're going to find out more now by talking with Steve Fish, who runs Left Feet and has also been organizing Manatee Night. Steve, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks very much. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Not too bad.
Yeah. How did you sleep last night?
I slept well, thank you.
Good.
I think that's just what I needed was a good night's sleep and the appropriate supplements.
Good stuff. So tell us about Manatee Nights.
Well, Manatee Nights, I guess it all kind of got started when I was speaking with Stephen Gardner from Fresen many months ago, and we had talked about trying to build a bit of a veggie night where people could come out and have a few drinks and maybe dance and socialize, and if they wanted to talk shop, then that would be a good place for it, and just generally feel fairly welcome.
And Fresen, just for people who don't know, is sort of this schmancy vegan restaurant in Toronto.
Yes, they're right. It's very schmancy.
It's a good date restaurant.
It is. It's a good date. And it's a good restaurant when family comes to town.
Yes.
You're sort of at a loss for where everyone's going to go for food.
So. Right. Food to impress.
That's right. So that was kind of how the idea got started, but I guess for myself, both my brother and I have been involved in music for pretty much most of our lives, and I think for me specifically, music is kind of how I came to vegetarianism and veganism in the first place.
Mm.
I think sort of protest music and political music kind of brought me to the discussion and kind of introduced me to the whole world of animal rights in the first place, and so, you know, it seems very appropriate that you would in turn share music with people again and in a social environment and try and encourage people to hang out together.
So are you DJing the night?
That's right, yeah. So my brother has a fairly immense soul and blues and jazz collection, but for the most part for Manatee Nights, he's been playing a lot of Southern soul music. And then between myself and some of the other guest DJs that we've had, we're trying to keep it fairly well-rounded, you know, everything from sort of, you know, electro rock and punk to some hip hop and pop music. Like it's all over the map. We're trying to have a lot of fun with it and not really have it be a genre specific night. So
do you have to show your vegan membership card to come?
Yeah, the vegan police work the door and
the vegan police bouncers.
That's right, vegan police bouncers are very scary people.
Right.
Yeah, that actually that kind of brings me to my other point, is that there's, and I think we've talked about this before, is just the how fractured the whole veg scene can be at times. And I have this sort of idealistic vision that one day vegetarians will actually all hang out together sometimes and maybe actually cooperate instead of, spending so much time policing one another and fighting, infighting.
So this is like a chance to let loose a little bit.
Well, yeah. I mean, I certainly think it's a great idea to get people together, like for exchanging ideas. But also sometimes it's okay to kind of put your politics in your pocket for 5 or 10 minutes and have a drink and just socialize in a very veg-friendly environment as well, too. So, you know, whatever people are comfortable with, I've certainly had some really amazing conversations with people at the night, and I've had just had a beer and a laugh with people too, so I think all those things should be encouraged.
It's interesting that you mention this too, because next week on the program we're speaking with a woman named Hillary Rettig, and she wrote this really fantastic book called The Lifelong Activist: How to Change the World Without Losing Your Way, and it's all about kind of like balance in your life and how not to get burnt out. And I think that, you know, something like Manatee Nights can maybe provide that little bit of like relaxation and fun, and a lot of people who study this stuff and are participating in the movement, there's just so much opportunity to feel down and to not get out enough and to not have that socializing time.
It's true. I mean, you can get really depressed with the statistics, and you can feel pretty down, like you feel like you're not getting anywhere with it, but I don't think it has to be that way. And I think, the healthier and more rounded we are, I think we're going to be more effective in our politics and our activism as well, so... That's sort of evolving and changing too. I mean, even this week, I was hoping that this would happen at some point, but I didn't know it was going to happen this soon. We named the night Manatee Nights. It was supposed to be a little bit, fun. I just love manatees as a creature.
I wanted to ask about that.
Okay, good. I'm glad we're getting to it. So, they're the herbivore of the sea, right? They're the sea cows, and I guess at night what happens when they, because they can't survive in cold water, and one of the reasons they're at risk is because they tend to gravitate towards very warm currents, and usually these are shallow waters. So they end up getting hit by boats a lot, and that's their one of their greatest greatest enemies. But at the nighttime, these sea cows, they actually they socialize together and pick nice warm shallow waters and just sort of bask in the moonlight. It's quite a romantic notion. But just this past week, there was actually someone who came to the night because he saw some of the posters, and he himself had sort of this odd fascination with manatees, and got himself involved in manatee adoption and sort of some outreach work. So he came to the night and brought me all kinds of educational information. And now we're working on doing a fundraiser for the Save the Manatee organization in Florida. So it's kind of cool that, like, through all this, what started out as totally just supposed to be a lot of fun, we're actually getting to make some contributions back to the manatees themselves, which is pretty amazing. So.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, that's very cool. So he actually brought... He adopted a manatee this year, so he brought a flag that says "Drive Slow, Manatees Below," and those are posted up all along shallow waters in Florida, apparently.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So I heard from Stephen Gardner of Fressen and Urban Herbivore that there was a theme night last Saturday, and I missed it. And Steve was really rubbing it in. He said he dressed up like a lobster.
He did. He was a champ. He wore like this enormous like full piece lobster outfit. It was pretty incredible. But yeah, the theme last week was was basically Aquarius, aqua theme, so there were a lot of February babies celebrating their birthday, and I don't know if that's going to be a reoccurring theme, if we're going to have birthday themes at least once a month so that people can collectively celebrate their birthdays. But we tried it out this time, and there just happened to be a lot of the staffers, too, at the Herbivore and Fressen that are born in February. Something about the Aquarius folks and the veggie.
Did people get up and dance? Like, what kind of, can you just paint the scene a little bit for us? Is it like a lounge night? Are people dancing? Like,
it's a little of both, actually. Like, some people choose to kind of just sort of stick close to the bar and talk amongst themselves, and some people, they cut some tile. They like to get up and move around, so.
And there's room to do that.
Yeah, and I'm, you know, we try and encourage that with the music and, but whatever people are feeling, you know.
Okay. And Fressen, for people who haven't been there, they do some pretty mean martinis. So I assume those were on tap as well? People were drinking those?
Yeah, they got, they have martinis, and they have, they actually have a manatee drink, which I found out after we named the night. But they have a lot of fresh juice-based drinks as well. They don't carry soda. Like, they don't have pop and, like, kind of glucose sugar-based drinks. But they do have a lot of fresh fruit drinks.
Mm-hmm. Are they still doing the chocolate martinis?
That's a good question.
I'll see if
I'm not a big martini guy myself, but I'll have to check the menu. I have a feeling that they do have a chocolate martini, but
what they used to do is they would get these beautiful martinis, and then they would swirl melted chocolate in there, and so then it would freeze into this like little chocolate sculpture, and then at the end you would like have this cool little chocolate sculpture you could eat. They were great.
That is schmancy.
Yeah, but with all these great fruit juices they have, you know, you can have your martini and feel like you're kind of you're doing something healthy, basically.
Yeah, exactly, healthy drinking.
So, Steve, tell us where Fressen is, where people can find out more information.
Sure. So, Fressen is 478 Queen Street West in downtown Toronto. And
when did this night start?
Well, we tried a couple of them. We tried a couple of the nights just before I left to do that promotional tour out west for the store.
Right.
And then we picked it back up in the new year, and we've been doing it every Saturday ever since. So we're gonna keep it going right through the winter, and then see how people feel about it in the spring. And you know, it may be a year long thing. Who knows?
And you're at 88 Nassau, right?
Yeah, the shop's at 88 Nassau.
Okay, I've clearly recommended this a number of times to people because I know that it's at 88 Nassau. This is in Kensington Market for people who want to go check out Left Feet, too.
Oh, thanks very much.
One of the things that I love the store, but I think that if you didn't see the shoes on the shelves, you might think it's a music store because it has that vibe to it. Just right before we go, you had mentioned that you got into some of these politics around animal issues and veggie stuff through bands, and I was wondering which bands in particular, if you have one or two you could mention.
Oh, interesting. Like, probably as far as Canadian rock bands and stuff, it was, like, I grew up just outside London, Ontario, and we were blessed with a venue called Call the Office, and there was also a place called The Embassy. So a lot of touring punk bands that came through. But, I mean, top of mind, I'm thinking of bands like Avail out of Virginia that are really heavily active with Food Not Bombs, and even, like, Propagandhi here in Canada, on the G7 Welcoming Committee label out of Winnipeg.
That was the band that got me to go vegan.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They were very instrumental, and I always loved their politics because they were, especially Propagandhi, were the first people to sort of, you know, point the gun at themselves, so to speak. Like, they weren't so righteous about it. They were like, I've made these mistakes, and here's how I've resolved them. And, so I'd say Propagandhi was pretty...
We interviewed Chris Hanna, actually, on the show.
Oh,
so
cool.
For people who want to find out more about Propagandhi, you can just do a search on animalvoices.ca and hear him talk about writing songs about animals and talking about veganism and stuff like that in some of their music.
Super bright guy.
Yeah, very nice. Well, Steve, thanks so much for being on the show.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
And we'll see you out there at Manatee Nights on Saturdays at Fressen Restaurant.
Amazing.
Okay, bye. Thanks.
Thank you.
That's Steve Fish. He is the owner of Left Feet, which is a vegan shoe store in Toronto, very heavily involved with the music scene as well. Go and check out those nights. I would have gone last Saturday, but we had some potential house fire issues we had to deal with. So hopefully we'll get out there on Saturday night. I would really encourage people to go out to this wonderful event. It's very ambitious that they're putting this together, and Fresnes is just a beautiful venue. It's a great place to hang out. We're going to take a short break, come back with Camilla Taylor, find out about veganerotica.com and about all of her artist work. Please stay tuned. Hello and welcome back to Animal Voices. You are listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. Before the break, we were speaking with Steve Fish, finding out about the vegan music lounge night that's happening at Fresen Restaurant called Manatee Nights. This happens on Saturdays. Definitely encourage people to go check it out. If you have any questions or comments for us at Animal Voices, please do write us at animalvoices@gmail.com. And our website is animalvoices.ca. There's a forum there for you to post comments if you so desire about any of the shows, as well as over 180 programs that are archived. So now we are turning to our interview with Camilla Taylor. I'm very excited to talk with her today about veganerotica.com, which is a site that is all about the manufacturing and the purchasing of handcrafted vegan bondage gear, whips, belts, harnesses, and other vegan leather, aka pleather, items. And it says here also that they sell vegan condoms and other sex products. Camilla has been involved with many different things. She sounds like a jack or a Jill of all trades. She has worked as a vegan pastry chef, does lots of cool art as well. We'll be talking to her about some of those projects. But in particular, we're going to be talking about veganerotica.com. Camilla, welcome to the program.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Oh, I'm all right.
How are you doing? I'm good. Are we reaching you in a coffee shop?
No, sadly. I slept in.
Oh, you decided to stay in.
Yeah, it's somewhat earlier here than it is where you guys are, so.
Right. And we're reaching you in Arizona.
Yes, that's right.
It's very cold in Toronto right now. What's it like there?
Jackets right now in Arizona.
Yeah.
That's about the extent of the weather.
I wanted to talk to you before we were speaking to you today. We were speaking with Steve Fish, who runs a vegan shoe store in Toronto called Left Feet. And we were using the term veganism and vegan, and I was using it a lot too, and we actually didn't define it. So I know that you're into selling and making vegan products. Can you give us your definition of vegan and veganism?
My definition basically is that it doesn't use any animal products whatsoever, including honey. But I kind of try to extend that to include humans, and so to include no exploitation of humans who otherwise would be helpless.
So it's a broader definition than just food for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because actually the sex toy industry is really highly supported by sweatshop labor and labor that is somewhat questionable in integrity. So I try to avoid that.
So was that part of the motivation then for getting involved with veganerotica.com, is wanting to provide those alternatives to sweatshop labor and that kind of thing for sex toys, sex-related accessories?
No, not really. The motivation behind getting involved with Vegan Erotica is probably far more selfish than that, but the motivation behind staying with it for so long was around the way sex toys are not always manufactured in the best ways possible.
Mm. So when did you actually get started? I know you had mentioned in your bio here that Eric Waters and Richard Hurst had originally started Vegan Erotica and putting out these items, and then you got involved. How did that happen?
They kind of got sick of running it because it was a very, very small company initially. It's still very small, but somewhat less so now. And they were initially getting maybe one or two orders a month, and they just had other projects that they wanted to do, and they were no longer interested in running it, and so they just got me on, and Richard taught me how to make everything. And at first, that's pretty much all it is I just made the old items, and then I slowly introduced new items into the catalog and changed a few things around and started an ad campaign so I could actually quit my horrible job working for the Alamo car rental company.
Right. So can I ask you, just to rewind for a moment, can I ask you how you got into veganism and these issues?
I got into veganism when I was just 21. I became vegan, so it's only 5 years ago, actually, that I became vegan. And one of the major reasons, actually, was my boyfriend at the time was vegan, and he had been vegan for years and years. And then we broke up, actually. And after we broke up, I became vegan. And then after I became vegan, we got back together.
Was that part of getting back together?
No, it was just sort of in the natural progression of things, I suppose. But I just think it's funny that I didn't want him to think that I was doing it because he had influenced me.
Yeah.
And so I didn't become vegan while we were dating. But, I mean, that's exactly why. It's because beforehand I didn't know any vegans. I became vegetarian when I was 8, so I know lots of vegetarians. But at the coffee shop, actually, where I was a vegan baker making vegan food.
I can't wait to talk about that.
I was not a vegan yet, and all these kids used to show up, and the way teenagers are and kids are is somewhat off-putting, I suppose. And I wasn't really attracted to it at first, and I didn't think that I could stay vegan, and so I never tried it. And then I saw how my boyfriend had been vegan for 10 years or so, and how he had no problems with finding food. He wasn't starving. And so it became far more appealing a prospect.
Was it about animals at that time, or was it sort of just to try on something new?
Oh, no, it was about animals at the time. It was never really for health or anything like that, although I guess I eat much more healthy now than I did beforehand, but
yeah.
It was definitely out of compassion and compassionate reasons that I became a vegan.
You mentioned becoming a vegan pastry chef, too. So this is something, you know, we did an interview with Isa Chandra Moskowitz, who does the Vegan Cupcakes Take Over the World book with her business partner. And this is, you know, one of the things, I think that show sort of challenges a lot of notions about vegan cooking and vegan food. And pastry definitely sounds like something that generally isn't vegan. Is it difficult being a vegan pastry chef?
No, not really. Before I became a vegan pastry chef, I was a non-vegan pastry chef, and it was hard. It's hard to adapt recipes to veganism somewhat because the physics of baking and the way that materials behave. It's somewhat hard to figure out how to achieve the same goals with somewhat different ingredients, but once you kind of get the hang of that, it's very, very easy. I just made a bunch of cupcakes last night, actually, for my friend's birthday party.
Was it from that cookbook?
No, not that cookbook. But I've heard much about that cookbook.
Yeah, it's all the rage right now. What kind of cupcakes did you make last night?
I made just chocolate cupcakes with chocolate chips in them and Jimmy's on the top, chocolate icing.
Nice. So I want to switch the focus now to talking a little bit more about veganerotica.com. I love the description of the site. It's passion for the compassionate. What kind of products, I guess, first do you offer? And what kind of items have you personally made? I know that part of what is really great about what you do is you do like custom made stuff too. So what can people expect when they go to your site?
A lot of bondage gear, pretty much. A lot of hitting toys and harnesses and restraints, and then a lot of belts. Actually, about 50% maybe of all my business is just in belts, which is not that exciting or sexy. But everyone notices the dildo harnesses, even if I make all my money in belts.
You also have these wrist cuffs, too, that are made out of the vegan leather that you use.
Mm-hmm.
So what kind of material is this that you're using exactly?
It's called Lorica, which is Italian for, I believe it's Italian for armor. And it's a petroleum-based product, and they manufacture it on this little island off the coast of Italy. in the Mediterranean Sea, and I import it in great, huge rolls. They won't accept any shipping besides FedEx, so it's ridiculously expensive just to ship it. And it's pretty much the highest quality pleather that's available on the planet. It breathes, and you can wash it, and it will not change the structure of it. It won't deface the surface in any way. Just wash it, because that's a very important aspect of the sex toys, that you can wash it afterwards.
Yep, I would guess. So this is a material then that responds, or people have found that, you know, it has those same, sort of some of the same properties that they might be looking for in something that was made out of leather.
Yeah, it does. It has many similar properties. Personally, I think it's superior to leather, just because you can wash it and you can't really wash leather. Leather changes if you wash it, and it loses its finish.
I'm imagining some people saying, well, why don't you just buy leather then? I know that one of the arguments that you respond to on the website is that some people think, well, if you're buying leather, you're not really supporting the slaughterhouse industry or the meat industry in general. You know, it's just a byproduct. In some ways, I think people can even envision it as somewhat as kind of recycling. How do you respond to that kind of critique?
Well, the slaughterhouse is funded by byproducts. The milk industry couldn't exist if there wasn't the slaughter of calves, of veal calves. The milk industry would not be financially viable, and it's the same with the cattle industry, that if they didn't sell leather from the carcasses, it would not be a financially viable system. So I don't think you can separate out the byproduct from the initial venture, because it still makes money. It'd be one thing if all of the leather was donated to nonprofits and then they'd make money from it. I suppose then it could be justified as being reused, but it's not the case.
So when people are looking at some of these items, I know that we've had people on the show before that have been really critical. Not everybody, certainly. We've done shows that have talked about it from many different angles. But some people have said, you know, like anything that promotes SM, this is promoting like a violent lifestyle. And if you're vegan, if you're into animal issues, you know, this is kind of against what that is about. And so people see it as kind of promoting violence. And I think that sometimes what's lost in that is that they don't necessarily talk about its consent between two different adults. But have you heard some of those sort of similar, like, general concerns about SM?
Oh, I've heard all manner of critiques about SM. And generally speaking, it just seems about prudishness, most problems people have with it. But I guess to address it from that perspective, from a vegan perspective and critique of SM, I don't understand how someone can liken potential violence between consenting adults to victimizing someone who's not consenting, because they're not the same at all, very clearly.
So you said that you get some, you've had other, so you've heard all manner of different critiques. Do people write you and ask you, you know, why are you doing this?
Yeah, I after a little while of doing vegan erotica, I started getting a little publicity, because people are so weirded out that someone can be compassionate and an ethical person and still want to be kinky. And some of the critiques have ranged from that no one can be into BDSM unless they're abused as a child sexually, or unless they're somehow a deviant and horrible person. And there's no way for it to be cruelty-free, because someone's always being subjugated in a situation. It just seems absurd. Because sex is strange, and people do strange things. And just because my clientele and people who are into S&M like to use gear to play out their fantasies doesn't make their particular fantasies any less bizarre and strange and potentially disturbing than people who don't like to use gear and like to play with feet, or like to, I don't know, look at strange hentai porn or any manner of other fetishes that people have.
So who is your clientele then? Is there quite a big market for these items that, you know, as you said that it's grown quite a bit since Eric Waters and Richard Hurst first got involved and were doing it?
There's a pretty big client base now. I think the thing is that BDSM does appeal to an awful lot of people because it essentially just plays with the power dynamic that exists in sex. And so it can appeal to vegans the way it appeals to anyone else. And so I have the entire kinky vegan community as my client base. And then I also have a lot of companies I wholesale to, like Good Vibration Smuckers, my dildo harnesses, because so many of their customers have been emailing them and trying to get them to carry a vegan alternative to their gear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, because there is a whole big leather scene, and for people who are interested in the, you know, being involved in a kinky community as well, you know, it's, I think that probably a lot of people just don't know that there are alternatives out there. Vegan Erotica seems to be one of the very few companies that's offering something like this.
Well, I know there's a little company in Australia that makes some stuff. I don't know what they make it out of. They don't use Lorica, but I know there's a little company in Australia that makes some vegan wrist restraints and bracelets. But that's the only company I found. Girl, I think, has a link to them on her site.
We're going to take a short break, and I wanted to come back and hear more about veganerotica.com, passion for the compassionate, and I wanted to find out more about your artistic endeavors outside of this as well.
Okay.
Please stay tuned to Animal Voices. We're going to play some ads, come back, and talk with Camille Taylor from veganerotica.com. Hello, and welcome back to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Lauren Corman, here with Carl Orzechowski, teching for us today. Our website is animalvoices.ca. This show will be programmed sometime within the next week or so, if you're interested in passing on the link to any of your friends. Today, we're speaking about veganerotica.com, passion for the compassionate, and we are speaking with Camilla Taylor. And I want to make sure that I'm saying your name right. Is it Camilla or Camila?
It's Camilla.
Okay, good. I wanted to go back a little bit and talk about some of the controversial aspects or what people might consider some of the controversies, and then we'll get rid of that stuff and we'll move on. One of the things, too, that I wanted to address is that some people, you know, one of the things that they might think about with SM is that there's sometimes sort of animal imagery that's invoked, you know, through things like using leashes and that kind of things, or collars even. And so I'm imagining that some people might think that this is, again, sort of against a vegan ethic or against animal rights. Can you weigh in on that? How do you sort of respond to some of those questions?
I don't really know how to respond. I feel like if there's no actual animal being involved, then there's no reason to object to it, because you potentially use the same stuff that you would use for an animal, maybe, doesn't mean that an animal will ever be involved.
So it's not about hurting an animal in a situation, obviously, like that. I think sometimes people, there's this idea of people who maybe are outside of the SM community, this idea of violence gets a bit confused about the sort of violence outside of consenting adults, and then violence sort of existing in general society, and then not the ability not to to see those two things as being separate or somehow maybe one feeding the other.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's violence in sex no matter what particular kink is being acted out. There's always violence, there's always power that's being played with. Just because it's being done more so in one situation, I don't think makes it unethical.
When people find out, like, what you do in your life, and when they find out that you are involved with, you know, you own veganerotica.com, do you sometimes get people raising their eyebrows at you or just not understanding?
Oh, yeah, I do an awful lot, but it seems like pretty much all of my friends are vegan atheists, so they don't generally object to it. I still kind of lie at family gatherings. To be honest, I come from a very conservative Mormon family, and I don't know if they're prepared to find out about BDSM, let alone that I'm here for it.
Do you think that they will find out one day?
No doubt. No doubt. Some of my cousins and such will eventually find out, but I don't know. My grandparents are pretty old. They're in their late 80s, and I almost feel like explaining to them what BDSM is just might push them over the edge beyond mortality. I just can't be responsible for that.
That makes sense. You said in your bio, too, that you were raised in a really conservative town. So you're coming from a conservative family, and then also you grew up in a conservative town in Utah.
Yeah, I grew up in Provo, Utah, which is literally the most conservative town in America. It was there was a poll done by Time magazine, and Provo, I guess, won. And it's politically the most conservative town in America.
Wow. And you said at the beginning of the interview that you went vegetarian when you were 8.
Yeah.
See that? Whenever I hear about kids going vegetarian, it just always amazes me, because I think in some ways it can be a very easy choice and a very difficult choice for little kids. But what brought you to being vegetarian at 8, and how did your family react to that?
Well, my family was on a camping trip, and while my family was getting dinner ready, I went for a walk around the campsite, and it was a big family gathering, because we used to go to these huge family reunions every year, and another family of, I think, third or fourth cousins, some distant relatives of mine were preparing their dinner, and everyone else was making hamburgers that night, because it was hamburger night, except them. They were making something else, and I asked them why they weren't eating hamburgers, because I was so excited, and they said, we don't eat that. And I asked them why, and they told me, because we don't want to eat anyone. We don't want to eat any animals. And I thought, hey, I don't want to either.
Right.
And I became vegetarian right then, and that's pretty much it. It was pretty easy for the most part, actually.
Your family was willing to let you be vegetarian?
Well, initially my family was not real happy about it, but I was pretty insistent, and I never ate meat after I decided not to, at least not intentionally. I don't know if it was snuck into anything. And so maybe because I was so stubborn, they just decided that there was not much they could do about it.
So you always felt that, you know, from a pretty young age, you felt a connection then between you and animals, not wanting to harm them?
I don't know that it was a connection so much as just a ethical eventuality, because everyone likes kitties and everyone likes puppies when they're kids, but they don't always make the leap to not wanting to eat them anymore. And it just seemed like that was very clearly the reasonable thing to do.
I wanted to hear more about some of the artistic stuff that you do. You have a bunch of really amazing, I don't know what you call them, they're like figurines or dolls that you've been making lately. I don't know if this is new stuff. So you have that project as well. What are some of your artistic things that you do outside of veganerotica.com?
I have a bachelor's degree from the University of Utah in fine art and printmaking. And really, Vegan Erotica is making bondage gear is kind of just my day job, so I can fund being an artist. As being an artist doesn't really make a lot of money for me anyway.
Yeah.
Maybe eventually it will. And last year I finished up a series of dolls, and they have ceramic faces and hands and feet and genitalia. They're actually going to be in a show in San Francisco on March 2nd at Simonis Cochin's Gallery, if anyone is potentially there.
We do have international listeners, so it is possible that someone listening to the program could actually go, which would be great.
That would be fantastic. I don't know anyone in San Francisco, so I'm trying to get as many people to show up as I can.
And it's going to be featuring these dolls, then? Is that primarily?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. So can you tell us about the inspiration behind the dolls? Like, I've looked at this site. I feel like I've looked at that site so many times, and I kind of keep going back to it. It's like they're very like compelling and kind of haunting, creepy but fun. I don't know. They're a strange mix of a bunch of different things. Can you tell us more about those?
I try to instill a sense of ambivalence in people when they view my art. I want people to feel delight and disgust at the same time.
Yeah, that's definitely how I've felt. Have people responded that way then, generally, when you've seen them interact?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's amazing. I love watching people at galleries look at them. It's fantastic. Especially people who don't always go to see art show up sometimes. Actually, I just heard a story from a gallery owner who I showed at their gallery in August, and evidently just last week some men showed up to the gallery and went up to their little counter and whispered to them, do you have the vagina dolls today? Can we see the vagina dolls? Like it was a peep show that they were coming to see. I was disappointed that I didn't still have any dolls there for them to see. Too bad.
Why is the sense of ambivalence that you're hoping to invoke in your audience, why is that important to you?
I like the way our emotions are very complex, the way we can think about more than one thing, and the way that we can feel multiple emotions at once, and that disparate emotions can be felt at the same time. Maybe the same way that BDSM can make you feel, because someone can feel like fear and loss at the same time, or I don't know, any permutation of that potentially.
Well, Camilla, I definitely want to encourage people to go check out some of your artwork as well. We'll link to that on our website, animalvoices.ca, but it's called horsefleshproductions.com for people who are interested in finding out more about some of those items. And they are for purchase as well on that website, too, if people want to contact you. Okay. And then you have a Flickr site as well with some more extensive photography of some of those items.
Yeah. Well, one of my best friends wanted to learn how to cook, and so I decided I'd start, because I bake and cook all of the food I eat myself pretty much. And so I decided to start teaching him over the internet. He was in a different state.
There's a mushroom stroganoff dish that looks really good on the Flickr site.
So I copied that from Sage's Cafe in Salt Lake City. It's not my recipe.
Okay. we're just about to end the program, but I wanted to ask you, you're in Arizona. I wanted to ask what it's like being vegan there. Have you seen like an uprising of vegan foods and availability and more of a vegan community or an animal rights community out there?
No, not really, honestly. I moved here from Salt Lake City, and I found that Salt Lake City was a far greater concentration of vegans. But I don't know. They're vegans no matter where you go. You just have to wait around, I guess, for them to find you. And I've been able to find quite a few friends. And it's funny. I just found out that my friends who were vegetarian just barely went vegan. They built a new house, and they decided that this was going to be a vegan house. They're going to never take animal products into it. So.
Wow. So you have some community around you, too, and I know that you're online and stuff as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks for being on the show today.
Well, thanks for having me.
For people, again, it's horsefleshproductions.com is where you can find Camilla's art, and if you're interested in some of her work through veganerotica.com, Passion for the Compassionate, check that out as well. I hope you have a good Valentine's Day, whatever you're up to. And thanks again for being on the show.
Bye-bye.
We were just speaking with Camilla Taylor. Carl, I know I haven't given you a lot of time for your segment here that I asked you to do. Do you want to read any part of that article?
I'll read just the introduction, because I think it's kind of it kind of draws the listener in. And if you want to hear more about fair trade chocolate, we can maybe
point you in
some directions on the website.
I really wanted to talk about fair trade chocolate. I think we need to set up a show in the future that talks about fair trade, shade grown, all that kind of stuff. So, over to you.
So this is from the Friends of Animals Action Line newsletter, and it's an article entitled "Fair Trade Chocolate: The Sweetest Direct Action You'll Ever Do," and it's by Lee Hall. Each day on the way to and from school, Charlie Bucket walks past the Wonka Chocolate Factory, breathing in the extraordinary aroma. Desperately curious to know the building's secrets, Charlie wins the chance after finding a golden ticket in a chocolate bar, one of only five golden tickets distributed by the eccentric Willy Wonka. With its new film adaptation of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Warner Brothers has produced some golden tickets of its own. In the first 3 months, it grossed over $200 million. The show's Wonka, played by a sleek Johnny Depp, goes off on expeditions, prepared to search the tropics for exotic sweets and to pluck plants or animals from the other lands at whim. After encountering a, quote, race of tiny people called Oompa Loompas, who live in huts, wear headdresses, and eat caterpillars but crave chocolate, Wonka takes them to work in the Wonka factory. The Oompa Loompas cannot leave, being unable to withstand the cool climate in their new land. They have no spoken language, and they all look alike. In fact, all of them are played by Deep Roy, an actor of Indian descent. The new film is largely true to the details of Roald Dahl's 1964 book, in which the Oompa Loompas, brought out of Africa, even purport to volunteer themselves for experiments so that Wonka, the European chocolatier, can test new product ingredients on them. A subsequent screen version starring Gene Wilder modified the work while Dahl agreed to rewrite the sections mentioning Oompa Loompas. This year's version, however, echoes the original tale's most troubling passages. The fast food chain Wendy's was quick to make toy Oompa Loompas as well as other film characters for premiums in kids' meals, providing yet another incentive for children to request trips to the burger shops. Savvy parents see such things as the marketing ploys they are. But do they sense the trouble in the message that living exotics, including humans, are natural resources to be bought and sold wherever a profit can be gained? Will they pick up on the irony that the history of chocolate involves the use of enslaved people even today? The group Free the Slaves counts 27 million people still in bondage in the world, many of them working on cocoa plantations, producing goods that end up in our local stores. That was mostly about the movie, to be honest. But I think it kind of starts pulling you in a direction more to thinking about where that sweet, sweet, sweet goodness of chocolate comes from.
We'll make sure we link to the whole article.
Yeah.
And I will keep trying to talk with people from Tropical Source and Chocolate Decadence about their fair trade chocolates and get people on the show that can talk about that. I want to let people know about next week, and actually we have the next couple of weeks booked up for programs. We are speaking with Hillary Rettig from, she wrote a book called The Lifelong Activist, How to Change the World Without Losing Your Way. This has been very helpful to me personally, thinking about activism and how to avoid burnout, certainly something that we keep going back to on the show in terms of avoiding and taking care of yourself. So that is next week on the show. And then we're going to be speaking with Steve Baker, who is a very famous, well-known academic who writes about animal representation. He has such books as Picturing the Beast and Postmodern Animal. I'm really thrilled that he's going to be on the show. So if you're interested in thinking about animal images and sort of getting into critical analysis around how animal images are used in popular media as well as by animal activists, there's just so much imagery that's relied upon in the animal movements to put forward the message. So he provides a critical reading of that in a really interesting way. So that's Steve Baker on February 27th. And again, next week we're going to be talking with Hillary Rettig about The Lifelong Activist. It's a fantastic book. We'll have a woman on, Jackie Kennelly, who is currently doing her PhD work at the University of British Columbia, who is focusing on activism, and she's going to come in and guest co-host with me. So we're out of time. Hope everybody has a great Valentine's Day if you are celebrating, and if you're not celebrating, then I hope that you have a good day regardless.
Please a good regular old day.
Good regular old day. You've been listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5. Please stay tuned for Roadrunner.